Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by CyberTrust.
Hello and welcome to Risky Business episode 13, thanks to our sponsor CyberTrust and hosting partner Vigabyte. Unlike last week's show, which descended into a bit of waffle, we've got heaps of fresh news for you today. It's been a very busy week in security. We'll also be chatting to Jeremiah Grossman, an internationally renowned web application security expert. David Shaw from our sponsor CyberTrust will be along to discuss recent moves by Australian financial institutions to shift the liability for fraud onto consumers. But first, as always, it's time to check in with Munir Katadia, ZDNet Australia's resident security expert. Now, Munir, it looks like Auscert, who are regular guests on this podcast, will not be releasing their annual computer crime survey this year.
No, it's a bit of a surprise. You know, I mean, last year they made a real big deal of it because they expanded the survey. They got some extra funding from the Attorney General's office, and, you know, they expanded the survey. They added a whole load more questions. They increased the number of people actually, you know, being asked the questions. And so last year's survey was a bit dodgy because it was, you know, we've got these figures, but you can't really compare them to the year before because it's a completely different survey.
That had been a recurring problem with that survey, you know, over the years. I've been assigned to cover that one for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So I've sort of followed it fairly well. And you also had a greatly varying sample size and, you know, a bit of self-selection bias. I mean, they happily acknowledged that it wasn't statistically valid, but it was just a really good barometer to see where things were going.
Yeah, well, it's a bit of a shame because it is something which I kind of look forward to every year because it's a nice indicator of what's going on out there. Mm. But this time it seems that the Australian Institute of Criminology will be doing a survey around November this year instead. And I'm not quite sure what the internal wranglings are going on, but, you know, it seems that Auscert may have missed out on the funding or...
The explicit comments that I've received by speaking to Auscert's general manager, Graham Ingram, is that... you know, it wasn't a case of their funding being withdrawn.
Hmm.
The AIC actually went up for, I believe, and we're not 100% sure about this, but funding from the Australian Research Council.
Yeah.
So they've got a much bigger wallop of money. And then they found out the AIC was doing this and they thought, well, what's the point of us doing another survey when this much bigger one is coming out later in the year?
Yeah. And when I spoke to Graham on Friday, actually, and he said, you know, he admitted that a lot of people wanted the survey to continue, but he said, you know, they're coming out with some new ideas. One thing that Graham said, which is quite interesting, was about the effect, you know, until now the survey's been a very, very business-focused, and he says a lot of the issues are coming from, you know, the smaller businesses or the consumer kind of areas, you know, with all the zombie PCs, and they're causing a lot of trouble. So I think they wanted to shift the focus a little bit to that area as well, which is why he said, yeah, it's not a big deal. We're just going to sit back and see how this survey goes.
For one, I'm going to be very interested to see the outcome of the Australian Institute of Criminology's survey because it is a different approach. It's a fresh approach with some new stuff. And, you know, the Auscert thing, we never really saw some wild trends in it, you know. So it would be really interesting to see a much better funded report.
Yep. And the one thing that Graham did say there, that he hasn't ruled out Auscert doing another survey. So there's a chance that it may be back next year. Who can
tell? Just want to wait and see if the AIC does a shit job or not, I
guess. Basically, yeah.
Okay. Now, it seems our cyber crooks are embracing QuickTime and WinZip exploits, which is fairly interesting because they've usually stuck to browser exploits and Microsoft products. But
Yeah, that's right. You know, I guess I'm not that surprised by this. They're basically exploiting vulnerabilities that have come out, you know, a while back. And we know that everyone's like moving up to the application side of things and trying to catch people off guard. These vulnerabilities that were found quite a while back, and at the time they didn't think that they were being exploited, but it seems, yes, they are. And so if you haven't patched up, then you're vulnerable. But, you know,
Thing is, too, of course, being QuickTime and WinZip, I mean, it's not tied into the whole Windows Update functionality, so people are probably going to be a lot more slack about patching them than they would be if it was a hole in, say, Internet Explorer.
That's a very good point. Yes, no, you're totally spot on there, and so I guess this they are a bit slower at updating these applications. Yeah.
Now it looks like Intel and PGP are cooperating on selling encryption products.
Yeah, how many times have we heard in the news, you know, about people losing their laptops and suddenly all these people's details are exposed, all these important information is suddenly left out there and it's vulnerable for somebody just finding a laptop, opening up, and there you go, you're logged in. So this is all about encrypting either files or folders or your entire hard drive, which I think is something, you know, should be commended, really. Yes, we need more of that.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how they actually implement it because, you know, with most PGP deployments, you know, your private key winds up on some hideously insecure bit of media, like a, you know, like a CD that's glued, you know, or tied with a piece of string around the server rack. And really all it is you're guarding a big password with a small password. So it's going to be interesting to see what the propeller heads come up with. And moving on, I guess Apple has fixed some more bugs.
That's right, this time on their media server, the Darwin streaming server. Apparently, the actual description here says that the vulnerabilities could allow a remote attacker to commandeer the system is running the application or cause it to crash.
Nyuk, nyuk. Sounds fantastic. Who, do you know, this is the latest in a series of bugs in Apple, isn't it? I mean, we had that, you know, super big patch that came after the month of Apple bugs.
Yeah.
And then we had the other one, the MacBook flaw that was exhibited at CanSec West.
Well, they definitely have been fixing an awful lot of bugs, but I can't say I've heard of many exploits at all. I mean, you know, apart from the QuickTime thing we just spoke about, I can't say there's been many exploits, so it still seems you're still relatively safe, but the fact that they're patching them, I guess that's a good thing.
Well, I guess they've developed all their malware for the Windows platform, so even though it's, well, they have. I mean, even though it's vulnerable Apple code that they're using in the QuickTime instance, you know, when they've actually got to drop their Trojan or rootkit, you know, they've got something that's developed, revision control, you know, it's up to version 10 or whatever it is.
Exactly, yeah.
For the bad guys. Now, we spoke last week about a bit of a drama with the Commonwealth Bank. Well, we didn't actually name them last week, but there was a bit of controversy last week when you wrote a story which sort of aired some claims made by an Australian company called Trust Defender, which claimed to have broken two-factor authentication for the bank. Now, you sent that story live and all hell broke loose.
Oh, it did, totally. And then suddenly we had a retraction from Trust Defender, and we were left there standing saying, okay, so we've got these guys, first of all, making a claim, and then them saying, actually, no, it's not true. It leaves us in a very, very strange position.
Did you actually see their demonstration?
Well, we did see a video demonstration, but then if afterwards they come out and say, you know, actually it didn't work at all, then I'm thinking, okay, so did you lie to us? What exactly did we see there?
Do you think, do you think it's possible, just possible, that the Commonwealth sent its team of extremely frightening zombie lawyers to go and really scare the crap out of these guys and coerce them into publishing some sort of retraction? Is that a possibility?
A possibility? I would say yes, it's very likely indeed. One of the things, one of the interesting points, though, you know, it's all about a matter of language. Now, on Friday, there was possibly a vulnerability that we saw them demonstrate. And at that time, Commonwealth Bank didn't complain about there being a vulnerability or inaccuracy in the story. But on Monday, they did. So was it the fact that they fixed the problems over the weekend and then suddenly, well, now your story is inaccurate? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then Trust Defender say, okay, we withdraw our claims because this doesn't work anymore because they fixed it. So no, it doesn't work anymore. I can't figure out exactly what happened. There are so many different possibilities.
Well, I think
there.
They were just trying to demonstrate, you know, a man in the middle on a token-based authentication system, which is, you know, nothing really that earth-shattering.
Mm-hmm.
They'd actually invited to fly me down from where I live, which I don't actually mention on the show. they'd offered to fly me down to Sydney to show me this this demonstration, and I just didn't really have time. And it, you know, it didn't really strike me as anything that earth-shattering. But it seems the Commonwealth were not impressed by
these
guys' claims.
They weren't. So I don't quite know what's happening there or whether we're going to hear from Trust Defender again. I'm sure we will. But, I wasn't too impressed with how that all worked out, really.
Now, of course, next week you and I are going to be meeting in the flesh for OSCERT.
We are indeed. Looking forward to that. That's the big one for us.
And, of course, for itradio.com.au listeners, we will be bringing you some very special programming from the field. and we'll actually get to hear Munir in the high fidelity sound. There's an old school term for you.
High fidelity.
Hi-fi.
Yes.
Munir coming to you in hi-fi on a 56k MP3, so I guess it all sort of evens out in the end.
No, I'm really looking forward to it. I'm going up there. It's going to be there for 4 days or so, and also it's just one of these places where you get the best security people turning up, and we always get some great stories from the show, so I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Munir, thank you very much again this week for speaking to Risky Business.
It's been a pleasure, Patrick.
Our thanks again to Munir for that. Now, normally we'd hear from an OSCERT staffer at this point of the podcast, but this week the boys are a little tied up. We've got a jam-packed show anyway, so we're going to move straight on to our first feature interview of the week. Jeremiah Grossman of White Hat Security in the United States is known as an expert in web application security. His blog has become a resource for web application geeks in its own right. He's even appeared on Australia's own Four Corners program, and on the first edition of this podcast, of course. Today, Risky Business spoke to Jeremiah about web application vulnerabilities. Online bugs are a tad more difficult to research than software bugs. If you want to find vulnerabilities in Windows, you can just set up a Windows box at your house. But how can someone ethically attack a web application without the permission of the people who maintain it? We spoke to Jeremiah to find out. So, Jeremiah, can you tell us, why is it such ethically complicated ground when you're researching vulnerabilities in web applications as opposed to standalone applications that you might have on a server in your house?
Well, the big difference between researching desktop software such as in Windows or OS X or Linux is both an ethical question, also a legal question. If you have software running on your desktop machine that you bought and you licensed, you can reasonably legally tear it apart without impacting anybody else. You can find vulnerabilities in it, report them to the vendor, and then you get into the ethics of vulnerability disclosure, responsible disclosure, full disclosure, and the like. But when you're dealing with websites and web applications, they normally reside on somebody else's web server, Yahoo, Google, your bank account. According to, different countries have different cybercrime laws, but in the U.S., you're not allowed to touch, access, or hack a system that's not your own.
So I guess herein lies the difference, doesn't it? Because I doubt your local bank is going to take too kindly to you trying to, even if you're trying to do it with altruistic motives, even trying to hack into your own account. The bank's probably not going to take a lovely view of that, are they?
Correct. It actually puts up a big question mark for the researcher, even the most benevolent of researchers, is that they really don't know how the other party might take it. They could say, we're okay with it, we're not going to do anything, just let us know if you find the results, or we're going to call law enforcement and we're going to have the FBI knock on your door.
Yes, we're going to have them come round with a big stick. So unlike areas around responsible disclosure and responsible research, the good actor rules in that field have sort of been established. How do you think we can strike the balance in the web application sphere? Because obviously, there's a lot of people out there who like researching this stuff, whose research would actually benefit these companies, because the bad guys don't care about ethics.
We've had vulnerability disclosure around for a while. We've been trying to hammer out the ethics for the last 15 years or so. We've gotten to a point where the researcher discloses the vulnerability, gives the vendor some time to patch, and everything's well and good. And, for the most part out there, when vulnerabilities are disclosed to, big website operators like Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, they take they're fine with it. Just show us where the vulnerabilities are. Please don't exploit it. That's where they get into the issues. If you're maliciously using a vulnerability on their website, they'll likely to call law enforcement. But if you're just disclosing it, they're okay with it. But that hasn't been 100% of the cases. There have been cases out there where researchers have been finding vulnerabilities and find themselves on the wrong end of law enforcement, even though they had no malice and intent.
Well, I guess a perfect example of that would be Adrian Lamo, who was on the podcast a few episodes back. I mean, he'd often, his MO was to hack in, usually through proxies or web front ends, and then say, "Look at what I found," and offer to fix it. And of course, that worked very well until he hacked the New York Times, at which point the full force of the United States law enforcement community came down on him.
Yeah, that's where it gets, one company might be okay with it, or might keep quiet about it, another company might not take so kindly to it. But if you pull back a little bit between Adrian's case, where he actually did get access to sensitive information, there have been times where, in the case of Daniel Cuthbert, the so-called tsunami hacker, when he was donating to a website, he found a vulnerability in a website, or at least attempted to find a vulnerability. And that was enough to trigger prosecution.
And what happened as a result of that prosecution?
I'm a little bit fuzzy on the details, but I believe he pled guilty to a particular cybercrime.
Well, it's kind of twisted logic, isn't it? Because you'd think the operators of that website would have been thankful for, someone at least trying to make sure that that was secure. Of course, it's difficult for them to measure the intention of the person testing for that, supposed vulnerability. But how can those... Obviously, this puts them in a bad position because they don't have web applications don't have the same level of scrutiny as normal applications that people can hack away at in their bedrooms.
That's correct, and that's the difficult time. It's a difficult time both for the security researchers that do this as a hobby or professionally or for fun and the like, and then you have these are actual businesses that just happen to write software that fuel their businesses, and they're not used to this whole the security and disclosure game. So, that's why it's hit or miss. Most everybody is uses basic common sense, but every once in a while there's a question mark and an incident arises, and then it kind of puts all the researchers in a little bit of a frenzy, like, what does this mean? Is this a trend to follow?
And how's the judiciary sort of coping with all of this? Are they just doing their typical confused old people in wigs thing, or are they actually across the issues?
From what I see in this case, is they're all fine with vulnerability disclosure and public websites until a complaint arises. So they depend upon the website operator to file a complaint, and then an investigation will ensue. So the power is really in the website operator's hands.
Now, you used to be the chief hacker at Yahoo, wasn't it? Was that the title?
My business card said the hacker Yahoo, but I was an information security officer in engineering.
The hacker Yahoo, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose you would have been on the receiving end of some bug reports and things like that. How did you respond?
Just like any big operator, where it's Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, we get bug reports all the time. We do our best to investigate. Our best to investigate each and every incident. You know, what is the vulnerability to verify it? Has it been used in the past? But we never went after anybody that was just reporting an issue that was what we felt counterproductive and would have made us likely a larger target rather than a smaller one.
Well, I believe that's actually how you got your job with Yahoo, wasn't it? It was by actually sending them a bug report.
Yeah, it was, this is way back in '99 when web security was just getting going, and breaking into my own Yahoo Mail account and then letting them know how I did it. I didn't think there was anything wrong with it. I wasn't impacting the system or anybody else. And as a result, I got a job. So if I said this was a bad thing, it would be a bad thing for anybody else to follow. It'd be somewhat hypocritical. My cautionary aspect to it is the world has changed, and other people might not be able to follow the same approach as easily as I was able to and come out. So that's the words of wisdom there.
Yeah, well, I guess it's an area to watch. Well, Jeremiah, thanks for coming onto the show again.
My pleasure, as always.
That was Jeremiah Grossman on the line from the United States, and we'll be right back after this.
Web security is hot, and security vendor Sophos is leading the charge to block networks against web-based spyware, viruses, malware, and unwanted applications at the gateway. To find out more, go to sophos.com.au. Sophos, security and control for safe and productive web browsing.
And welcome back. You're listening to itradio.com.au's weekly security podcast, Risky Business, with me, Patrick Gray. For those of you interested in networking and systems integration, don't forget to stop by on Wednesdays to hear a series of Tubes with Ian Yates right here on itradio.com.au. That's our networking and systems integration podcast. It's also weekly. But now on Risky Business, it's time for our sponsor interview. Each week, we like to have someone on the line from our sponsor CyberTrust to speak about a recent trend or news item. This week, it's David Shaw. So, David,
look, if what we're reading in the press is to be believed, it looks like the banks are trying to shift liability onto consumers for fraud.
There certainly seems to have been an interesting flurry of stories about this, and also some interesting attempts to clarify the position of banks in their submission to ASIC.
Mm.
But it's without going into the, which side is right and which side is wrong regarding shifting liability onto individual consumers, I think that it's good that the debate happens. From a personal point of view, I certainly wouldn't want the liability pushed onto me.
Mm.
Unless it was something that was transparently obvious. And I had choice in the matter.
Well, just for listeners who may not necessarily be across this story, it looks like some Australian financial institutions have suggested that they shouldn't be liable for fraud resulting from things like phishing scams if the home user hasn't taken reasonable steps to secure their computer. And of course, it's quite a controversial position. It looks like a couple of banks, according to the Australian Financial Review, Suncorp and Bendigo Bank, are looking to do that, whereas the move has been rejected by Commonwealth and Westpac, which are two of the bigger banks here in Australia.
It's interesting that Suncorp were out in the papers today saying that they'd like to correct the misinterpretation of their submission to the Australian Securities and Investment Commission. I think the position that they're trying to take is that where there is possibly repeated evidence of fraudulent transactions coming from a poorly set up home machine, that they reserve the right to remove the service and possibly also
I guess this free pass sort of mentality that the consumers have been getting, I mean, surely there's got to be some cases of fraud which aren't related to computer crime, but people can very easily blame them on the mysterious phishers or Trojan on their machine. I mean, is that something the banks are concerned about?
Look, I think the banks are always concerned when behaviour doesn't match their expectations. All banks are fairly sophisticated in looking at the incidence of fraud of all types, and they build that into their rates, the margins that you and I pay for these products. My point is that someday in the future I may be offered two different types of accounts, say, one of which has an insurance component built in and therefore a slightly higher rate to limit my liability, and the other one where I'm saying I'm such a sophisticated home user and I've got all these super duper firewalls and things that I'll accept the lower rate.
Well, it seems that the banks are actually treating security these days as a bit of a competitive advantage, a bit of a differentiator. So, I'd be surprised to see that there wouldn't be an effect on the business of banks that weren't offering coverage compared to those who were. I mean, there's got to be a difference there. Now, also, one of the angles that has cropped up through this story is that the cost of proper forensic analysis of home users' computers that may have been taken by some sort of fraudulent scam seems quite prohibitive, doesn't it?
Anything that's going to involve time and possibly moving a computer somewhere to have it forensically tested, whatever that means, is a cost that would have to be considered. But look, it comes back to some pretty simple things, doesn't it? You could probably replay this from my past articles. Yeah, it's education of the consumer. It's repeating the education. It's all about defense in depth, and it's not only technology, and so on and so forth. There's policies and processes in place, and as usual, there's headline generation too. If you the other article which you may well be covering this week was about the supposed cracking of two-factor authentication.
Yeah, look, we had a bit of a chat to Munir Katadia about that earlier, and that was a bloody mess, that whole scenario. So submissions have been made to ASIC. What happens next? I mean, is this something that is going to result in a change of a law, or what's the next step?
Well, I don't believe it will result in the change of law. Police forces have come out certainly wanting not to change the status quo. I think the good thing is it will highlight in everyone's consciousness the fact that you have to be careful, using your computers or someone else's computers, and you have to expect that there are going to be issues. In the analysis that I did some years ago on an internet banking system, I identified 27 points of attack. But it's a case of how one mitigates against those points of attack, both on the things that the consumer is responsible and the areas where the bank is responsible.
Okay, well, David, thank you very much for taking some time out to speak to us.
Patrick, thank you.
Well, that's it for another edition of Risky Business, thanks to our sponsor CyberTrust and hosting partner Vigabyte. But before we go, I've got something here I've just been dying to play. For the last couple of weeks, I haven't been able to make long-distance phone calls from the Risky Business phone line. I've paid all my bills, so I wondered what was going on. I rang my phone company and, well, you just have to have a listen to this yourself to believe it.
So you're telling me that my phone is set up to make calls long-distance through another company?
That's what I'm saying, yeah.
And you can't tell me who that company is?
That's correct, yes.
And I'm not getting any bills from...
I'd say the reason why they've suddenly stopped you having long-distance calls is they must have a different billing address to what they've got, what was there. They've been sending the bills to the old address, and because they haven't been paid, they've put a bar on that service. That's what I would imagine.
So how do I go about making long-distance phone calls again?
You'll need to find out who your provider is at the moment for the long-distance calls.
And that's the end of the recording. For a fun experiment, take those 35 seconds of audio and loop them. There is a hole in the bucket, dear Liza, indeed. Thanks again for listening, and if anyone out there happens to know which phone company I'm apparently with to make long-distance phone calls, let me know, because it's a total bloody mystery to me.